The first eight sermons were spent on examining God's purpose and design for marriage, as well as finding solutions to the foolishness that so often does enter into marriage and erodes and destroys it. I spent a lot of time on that subject because there's a lot more at stake in marriage than just the happiness of the couple. Marriage is the beginning of the family and the foundation of society, and we need to understand that. Strong marriages result in strong families and a stable society. Weak marriages not only result in dysfunctional families, but also in a decaying society. Proverbs 14:1 states, "The wise woman builds her house, but the foolish one tears it down with her own hands." The same thing is true of men. If you are married, make sure you are making it a proper priority in your life. Put the time, the energy into it to build it according to God's design. At the same time, act to combat the foolishness that would seek to destroy it, to erode it. And that begins by becoming humble. Recognize the foolishness you've allowed into your marriage, your own actions, your own attitudes, and repent of those things. It does take hard work. If you want more on that, go back and get the sermons that we preach. They're online. Or if you want, we'll make copies for you. Just let Sandy Garcia know. If you are not married, then please be supportive of those that are. They do need your encouragement. Also, if you are not married, but that may be some possibility in the future, then now is the time to be preparing those characteristics you'll need for that, so that you can be the godly spouse our Lord would want. I also have spent the last 2 months dealing with the issues of parenting. Now understand from the very beginning, it is the parents' responsibility to instill godliness into their children. That begins with their own example of their own love for the Lord, and then diligently training their children to know Him, to know His commandments, and to be obedient to Him. Now, God has placed upon us these responsibilities, a lot of specific things that we have to fulfill, and then we need to teach our children to fulfill those responsibilities as well. There are responsibilities within the family, responsibilities to the mother, to the father, parents, to the children, siblings between each other. There are responsibilities to extended family, to grandparents and aunts and uncles and all the various cousins that may be around. We have responsibilities towards other people in our communities, including fellow believers and especially fellow believers. We have responsibility to those who are in positions of authority, to those who are older, to peers, and to the poor. Now, these things in turn place responsibilities upon us in how we deal with property, both our own property and that of others. But ultimately, remember that God owns it all, including our bodies. So how we treat everything becomes important. It becomes a manifestation of our own walk with God. Now, all of that can be summarized by saying that we are responsible to treat everyone and everything with proper respect because it all belongs to God. I am to view and treat other people precious because though we are horribly marred by sin, not all that God would want us to be, yet God has still made us in His image. And we are to reflect that. Our worth comes from that and that alone. That's what makes us different, being made in the image of God. I am also to love others, not just neighbors, but as Jesus said, even my enemies. That's His command. So out of respect to them, I treat their property properly too. If I'm not sure what that means, I simply need to follow what the golden rule is. Jesus said that in Matthew 7:12, to treat others the way we'd like them to treat us. Why? Because in doing that, you fulfill the law and the prophets. Now, those are things we've already covered. And last week, I was able to cover teaching your children the proper treatment of property, including tangible possessions and intangible ones, time and reputation. But I didn't quite get to nature, and I want to talk about that briefly. And then I want to address the subject of biblical discipline of children. Now, I could spend a lot of time on nature because there is so much foolishness out there now. The modern environmental movement has gone nuts. They're wacko. I'm not sure else what other terms you can use. Because they've gone far beyond a desire to protect nature into a worship of it. Now, the vast majority of all these issues can really be dealt with by pointing out two very simple facts. So I'm going to reduce what could spend weeks on to about 5 minutes or less. The first fact, okay? All nature belongs to God because He created it. So in any sense in which nature is worshipped or some divine attribute is given to it, is blasphemy. And yet that is the heart of modern environmentalism. It is a worship of nature. It is attributing to nature divine qualities. Let me be clear. Nature is not your mother, and neither is the earth, and time is not your father. You have one creator. He is the Lord God, creator of heaven and earth. Okay? That's the foundation. Second, God has made man a steward of all the earth and all animal life on it. It's Genesis 1:28. And so God has given man the right to rule over and use the resource of the earth for his own benefit. And for those who are vegetarian, that's fine if you want to be that. But understand that he's also given man the right to eat meat. That's in Genesis 9. However, because he's a steward, it means that God is going to hold him accountable for how he uses all those things. Now, that's also contrary to a large portion of the modern environmental movement, in which man is at best only a co-equal life form with all the other life forms on the planet. And some of these groups consider you, as a human, a parasite. Well, then how should man use nature, and what should you teach your children? Well, first, use the earth's resources wisely as a steward who is accountable to God. Second, treat everything with thoughtfulness and respect for the other people that are coming behind you. That principle goes back again to the golden rule. Treat others the way you would like them to treat you. Nature does not belong to you individually. It belongs to everybody else that is going to use it. And ultimately, it all belongs to God. So you can see where these principles of property go right back into working with nature. Now, one simple way to teach these ideas to your children is teach them not to litter. Why? Because if you litter, it is rude to everybody else that comes behind you. Nobody wants to see your trash, and you don't want to see their trash, right? Teach them even to go beyond that and pick up trash, including that which belongs to somebody else, so that it is nicer for the people coming behind you so they can enjoy what they get to see, because nobody likes to see the trash. So it's a very simple principle, isn't it? And that's going to carry on into a whole lot of things and how you do anything in nature. Do you care about those who are coming behind you? Now, the dominion over the earth that God has entrusted man allows him to change the environment to enhance its beauty and its usefulness with such things as gardening, landscaping, farming, ranching. It's also acceptable before God to harvest what is useful from nature. That would include things like hunting, and gathering, and fishing, and forestry, and yes, even mining. Now, at the same time, we find that Proverbs is very specific and warns about cruelty and wanton destruction. Those are actions of the wicked. Proverbs 12:10 points out, a righteous man has regard for the life of his animal, but even the compassion of the wicked is cruel. We are the opposite of that. Responsible stewardship is not going to destroy the potential for future harvests. It cares about those who are coming behind. If in the case of mining, it means damage done to the land and extracting the minerals is going to be minimized, and the land's going to, you're trying to restore it to usefulness after you're done. You get the minerals out, that's fine, just restore it. Those are proper practices of stewardship. God has also given man the freedom to change the environment by doing things like building homes. Most of you live in a house? Anybody live out in the woods? No. You like your house? You like air conditioning? You like heating in the winter? That's changing your environment, isn't it? We have that freedom. We can build cities. We are allowed to build roads. We can engage in manufacturing and commerce. But again, we find that all these activities are limited by the proper use of property with a thoughtfulness and respect for others. So the benefits for all must outweigh the harm. Pollution, we seek to minimize it because it can harm other people. We as much as possible, and if others are affected, we seek to compensate them fairly. Now, all this then goes back to something very simple. Teach your children to be good stewards and good neighbors. If you teach them simply those two principles, they will treat nature properly. Told you it'd only take 5 minutes. Took on the whole environmental movement just in that. And I'm sure once this gets online, I have people upset with me. But do understand that at the heart of the modern environmental movement is a worship of the environment, of the earth. That's the problem. We should never have a problem with anybody challenging us about our stewardship and can we be a better steward of what we have. That's always proper. Well, we've covered the general responsibilities we have before God and what we're to teach our children. And I've given a lot of practical examples over the last couple months about teaching those principles to your children. For the rest of this morning, I want to cover the principles of biblical discipline. Now, I warn you in advance that though these principles once were the dominant way in which children were trained in the United States, they now stand in stark contrast to the foolish practices that are part of our modern society. Now, the first thing to understand about biblical discipline is that it's multifaceted. It covers both positive and negative aspects of rearing children. The root word translated as discipline in the Hebrew Scriptures is yesar. It means to teach and to train. It's used in Proverbs 19:18 and a whole lot of other places. This word and its cognates are used to refer to training that ranges from oral instruction, words used that way in Deuteronomy 4:36, all the way to physical chastening, as in Proverbs 22, verse 1. It's translated the Septuagint, that's the Greek translation of the Scriptures, as deo, which means to bring up a child, and it's translated variously as to teach, to discipline, to punish. So there's a wide range of meaning in this whole idea of discipline, and we'll talk more about the different aspects in a minute. But the second thing I want you to understand as a general principle is that biblical discipline has a specific purpose, actually two, to bring about wisdom and godliness. They go hand in hand. In Proverbs 19, verse 20, we find it says, "Listen to counsel and accept discipline that you may be wise the rest of your days." It takes that to become wise. Hebrews chapter 12, verses 5 and 6, quotes from Proverbs 3, 11 and 12. And there it is, encourage them in the midst of persecution and their striving to walk in holiness. It says, "Have you forgotten this exhortation which is addressed to you as sons? My son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor faint when you are reproved by him. For those whom the Lord loves, he disciplines, and he scourges every son whom he receives." You drop down to verse 10, and you find this very specific purpose. "He disciplines us for our good, so that we may share in his holiness." So the purpose of wisdom, gaining wisdom, growing in wisdom, and godliness must be kept in mind in all aspects of discipline. That's the purpose of it. Now, discipline begins with teaching and training. This is the positive side of it. We teach and train those who are without knowledge, without understanding. Remember at the beginning of Proverbs, in the introduction, Proverbs chapter 1, verses 2 through 6, it tells the purpose of the book. And it includes these areas. It is to know wisdom and instruction, to discern the sayings of understanding, to receive instruction in wise behavior, righteous justice, and equity, and to give prudence to the naive, to the youth, knowledge, and discretion. Children arrive in this world ignorant, right? They don't come knowing anything. It's amazing that so many want to go back and want to get the wisdom of the kids. They don't have it. They're ignorant. You have to teach them to be wise. They don't have wisdom. They don't have prudence. They don't have discretion. They don't have even the basic knowledge. It is the parents' responsibility to see to it that their children are taught and trained. And that begins with the fear of the Lord. That's the beginning of knowledge, and it is the instruction for wisdom, Proverbs 1:7, Proverbs 15:33. This is the point we've been making throughout all this period of time in studying principles of parenting of Deuteronomy 6:4 through 9. You must love the Lord God yourself with all your heart, with all your mind, with all your strength, and then you have to diligently teach that to your children. And that's in all the different aspects of life. You sit, you get up, you go out, by the way, sit, whatever you're doing, you've got to be pointing out God, His character, and His commandments to your children. Now, throughout Proverbs, we also see the same theme repeated for parents of teaching their children. Let me give you a couple examples. First, Proverbs 1:8. Hear, my son, your father's instruction, and do not forsake your mother's teaching. Proverbs 3:1, my son, do not forget my teaching, but let your heart keep my commandments. Proverbs 4:1 and 2, hear, O sons, the instruction of a father, give attention that you may gain understanding, for I give you sound teaching, do not abandon my instruction. Then Proverbs 6:20 through 23, my son, observe the commandment of your father. Do not forsake the teaching of your mother. Bind them continually on your heart. Tie them around your neck. When you walk about, they will guide you. When you sleep, they will watch over you. When you awake, they will talk to you. For the commandment is a lamp, the teaching is a light. The reproofs for discipline are the way of life. So it is our responsibility as parents to teach our children. But this call to instruct and learn also occurs throughout Proverbs in general terms, not just to the parents. In other words, it's not just parents that teach and train children. There is a general responsibility for the wise to teach those who are not wise, and for those who are naive, those who are ignorant, to seek out and learn, to become wise. Proverbs 16:23, the heart of the wise instructs his mouth and adds persuasiveness to his lips. Proverbs 19:20, listen to counsel, accept discipline, that you may be wise the rest of your days. In our earlier study, when we looked at the call of wisdom, we found that wisdom shouted in the streets to everybody to come and learn and become wise. It called out to the naive and to those that would easily be led astray to come and learn. It invited those who were naive to come into its house and gain wisdom. That's for everybody. So while it's the parents' responsibility to teach their children, the wise parents takes advantage of what other people can offer instructing their children in the various skills they need, the various lessons they need to learn in life. And in addition, all of us, adults included, need to be active in teaching others and learning from others so that we can gain godly wisdom. So where you're wise, teach those that are not wise there. Where you're not so wise, go find a person who's wise and learn from them. Learning is something that really is throughout life, isn't it? We're always going to be learning and growing, at least we should. Now, the first step in a lifetime endeavor of learning is don't forget the lessons you already supposedly learned, right? Proverbs 4:3, take hold of instruction, do not let go. Guard her, for she is your life. Yet too often we do forget the lessons we supposedly learned earlier. Well, then, whatever you've learned, you've got to go on and learn more. Now, that learning could come from your own observations and experience. Proverbs 24:32 addresses that. It talks about watching someone foolish, and it says, when I saw, I reflected upon it. I looked, I received instruction. I was watching somebody else, and I learned a lesson the easy way by watching them go through troubles. I think I'll avoid it. I won't do it that way. Isn't that a better way to learn? I like that way of learning. This other way is really a pain. But unfortunately, so often we have to go through that to finally learn, don't we? Now, the lessons you learn may come from others. Proverbs 9:9 talks about that. Give instruction to a wise man, he will still be wiser. Teach a righteous man, he will increase in his learning. That's a mark of wise people. They're always going out and learning more. The truly wise actually will seek out other people, not just something that's brought to them. They will seek it out. Proverbs 1:5, a wise man will hear an increase in learning. A man of understanding will acquire wise counsel. They're not passive in it, they're active. So regardless of the initial source or the initial motivation, those who are wise are going to value the instruction they receive, and they're going to heed it. Proverbs 8:10, instruction is described as more valuable than silver, and knowledge is described as more valuable than gold. We go out and labor a lot to earn some money. Do we labor as hard to gain wisdom? We find in Proverbs that we should. Proverbs 8:33 talks about wisdom issuing its call to heed instruction, be wise, and do not neglect it. Proverbs 10:17 says those who are on that path, the path of wisdom, are on the path of life. So these are not secondary issues. These are primary for us. If you want to be on the path that is life, a good life, a long life, it has to be the path of wisdom, not foolishness. To describe something as child is actually a good way to describe the actions of those who are ignorant and not yet developed needed skills. Proverbs 22:6 says, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he's old he will not depart from it. It uses a specific Hebrew word there, hinak. It describes training. And the word itself refers to rubbing the palate, the tongue, of a young child and teaching the child to eat. Some of you remember as young mothers, as you're first trying to give your child semi-solid food and trying to get them to keep it in, right? And they're going, nah, nah, and it's all coming out. They sort of enjoy it, but you're not sure because more is coming out than getting in. But you train them so they can finally eat and keep it in. And then you got to make sure that most of it stays on the plate and not all over the floor and stuff, too. That's another part of parenting. But this is the idea of training. It's a learned process. It's an encouraging kind of thing to do. You grow out of childishness as you are taught and trained. Paul even commented that in 1 Corinthians 13:11. When I was a child, I used to speak like a child, I thought like a child, I reasoned like a child. He said, but when I became a man, I put away childish things. We don't remain children. At least we shouldn't remain children. As we're taught and trained, we gain maturity. Let me give you some examples of childishness. Why does a baby cry? Well, a baby cries because he's hungry or something else is going on and knows no other way of communicating. That's a childish thing to do. It's normal. It's to be expected. As the child grows, you teach the child to communicate his whatever he needs in a more appropriate way. Eventually, they learn to speak. You can teach them sign language earlier on before they can master their tongue and form words. But that's why they cry. Toddlers, we give them little cups that have these lids on it that have a little hole so they can sit through it. Why? Because they don't have the dexterity with their hands to hold the cup well, and they keep knocking the thing over. And milk is expensive. So we only want a little milk spilled out that little bitty hole. It's childish. We don't get mad at a little toddler because they can't hold the cup right. We train them. If we know that young children will reach for hot pans, they're curious, or they try to stick things in electrical sockets. So we as parents make provision to try to protect them from those things while we teach them not to do them, to protect themselves. You have a boy begins to play baseball, can't hit the ball. Why? Doesn't have the hand-eye coordination yet to get the bat where the ball is going to be. You have to train the child for that, or to get the ball through the basket if he's playing basketball. You got to develop the strength to even get the ball up that high to begin with, right? That's childishness. If you have you're starting in algebra. I don't hear a whole lot of excitement for algebra. Only Melanie. Melanie is the only one smiling there. Yes! Okay, and you get this problem and you can't figure it out, you get it wrong. Why? You don't understand the concept yet. That's childishness. You just don't know. Now, all those things, these are marks of childishness. Childishness is overcome by teaching and training. The Hebrew word translated in the Proverbs here is actually Torah. You also get the word law from it. It means you instruct your child by giving them the needed knowledge, especially what God has commanded. You train them by giving them opportunity to put in practice what they've been learning. You can't just leave it up to some sort of intellectual knowledge. They've got to put it into practice. And the way you then treat childish behavior is very different from the way you're going to respond to foolish behavior, which rises out of rebellion. When it comes to childishness, you've got to be positive, encouraging. You want to help them gain knowledge and strength and skills. You praise them as they gain new lessons and gain new skills. You may even want to reward them for what they're doing as just a means of encouragement as they're gaining those skills. And let's say you do that in potty training. You can start right there. You give them a little reward when they're successful. And that continues on as our kids were developing their musical skills. It's, you know, you get this down, you know, we'll do this for you. We're more than willing to buy a better guitar for you once you've got the skills down. Still using it with Jimmy. Once he gets a certificate for welding, I'm buying him a welder because I really wanted to encourage him to do that. Those are goal incentives. That's encouraging. There's nothing berating, nothing negative about that. That's a positive thing to do. That's how you teach and train. It's from the positive side. There should never be punishment for childishness. But that is not true when it comes to foolishness. And this is the negative side of discipline. Foolishness is the rebellion that is in the heart of a child that prods him to do things his own way, regardless of what instructions and warnings he's received. At the heart of it is a rebellion. A toddler is playing with their cup, and you tell them, stop playing with their cup, and they continue to do it, and now spill it. That's no longer childishness. That's moved into foolishness. They've disobeyed your instruction. The child is playing ball and is striking out because they refuse to do what the coach is telling them to do. Their way is better. That's no longer childishness. That is foolishness. You go in for your math test and you fail. Why? You refuse to do your homework. You're too busy out playing with your friends. You didn't master the concepts. That's foolishness, not childishness. See the big difference? And because foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child, as Proverbs 22:15 tells us, the positive aspects of teaching and training will never be enough. I wish they were. But there needs to be warning, there needs to be correction, there needs to be chastening. The failure to be aware of and implement the negative side of discipline can be catastrophic. Proverbs 19:18 states this very directly. Discipline your son while there is hope, and do not desire his death. That's a pretty strong statement, isn't it? The word for discipline, this verse, is once again this general term, yesar. And so it includes everything from oral instruction all the way to physical chastening. The emphasis in this particular proverb is that discipline needs to be carried out before the bad habits and the bad character is formed. To fail to do so is to desire the death of your son, because that is where the foolishness will lead him. There's a lot of Proverbs dealing with that. Proverbs 14:12. There is a way which seems right to a man, but the end thereof are the ways of death. That's the heart of foolishness, this rebellion. It's right to me, I'll do it my way. But the end of it is death. You're to teach your children the fear of the Lord. That is the beginning. That is the fountain of life. That is what helps them avoid the snares of death. Proverbs 13:14 and 14:27. Now, the negative side of discipline begins with warnings. These actually should be included as part of your teachings, your instructions, your training. You explain the reasons for your instructions. You help them understand the principles by which you want them to function. That's the positive side. in the warnings, you're also giving them instruction about the consequences if they don't heed what you're saying. That's also part of the moral reason. Do it this way, here's the blessing. Don't do it this way, because this is what's going to happen, it's really bad. That gives them moral reasoning so that no matter what situation they face, they can apply the principles themselves. We teach our children these principles. That's what we want them to do. So warning of possible consequences of not following the instructions helps them understand the connection between actions and the results. Let me give you an example. From the positive side, you instruct your child to take good care of their bicycle. Put it away. This is the proper way to care for the things you own, bicycle or whatever else it may be. Now, if the love of righteousness was so strong and they just want to be a good steward, that would be all the instruction you'd ever have to give them. Of course I will. I want to take good care of my bike. I'm putting it away. But none of us have children like that, because none of us are that way. We have to also give the warning side. If you leave your bicycle outside, the dew is going to get on it, it's going to rain on it, it's going to rust, and someone may steal it. Okay? There's the warning. It will start disintegrating in front of your very eyes, or someone's going to steal it. When the bike does get rusty and or it is stolen, the connection between the failure to obey and the negative results, easily understood, the natural consequence is sufficient punishment to teach the lesson. Warnings are given before anything negative happens. It's a means of prevention. Proverbs 19:27 says, "Cease listening, my son, to discipline, and you will stray from the words of knowledge." So give them discipline before they start straying. Now, most of the discipline of your children should actually be on the positive side of teaching and training as you instruct, encourage them in doing what is right. Warnings, again, are included. Increase their understanding, the reasons for the instructions. Prevent the foolishness before they take place. I cannot emphasize enough that you need to teach your child and to make sure that your child understands what has been taught and what is expected before you bring about negative consequences. If you do not, you end up violating the principle of Colossians 3:21, because you're going to exasperate your child. You're going to cause them to lose heart because from their standpoint, you're completely unreasonable. I don't even know what you're talking about, much less able to do it. And yet now you're punishing me? You completely exasperate them. So make sure you've taught, they understand, and they can do it. Then you got to hold them accountable. So teach, train, fulfill the instructions, hold them accountable for obedience as it was taught. However, understand that this doesn't take a long time, a couple of days, maybe maximum of a week. But after that, you need to hold them accountable. Don't give your children excuses for their disobedience either. We've seen that quite a bit. Well, they don't understand yet. Well, why don't they understand? Well, it's your responsibility. Make sure they learn it. And it doesn't really take that long. Let me give you an example. We talked earlier in this series about children need to obey the first time right away with a happy face. How do you teach that? Well, we taught our children when they were old enough to walk and talk, we taught them this. And it was very simple. You need to answer us when we call your name, yes sir, yes ma'am, and then you need to come to us immediately. And we made a game of it. See, I think teaching should be fun. So while they're little tykes, Diane's on one side of the room and I'm on the other, and it's, I call them, yes sir, yes ma'am, and they come running, we give them big hugs. And they get all excited, and you do that for a little while, and then you expand it. I go in the other room, and they call, and they're excited, and they come, you give them big hugs, and you're very happy with them, and then you get to the other side of the house, and they're calling from a big distance, or they have to come upstairs and downstairs, but you're so excited. It's a game. Practice that a couple times a day, 3-4 times a day, do it for 3 or 4 days, guess what? They got it. They understand. I call, they come, they get a hug. This is great, right? Well, after they've learned this lesson, and you've done this for several days, you also have to warn them, if you don't come, there could be consequences. You need to do this. And then you call them and they don't come, and you have to make sure there are some consequences. That's what escalates it, the disobedience, the rebellion. When a warning is not heeded, you step up the negative side of discipline to a verbal rebuke. The verbal rebuke points out the disobedience. Now, if this is new instruction or the child is generally characterized by obedience, then that rebuke may be enough. We'll go back to the example of the bicycle. It may be enough simply remind them, I see your bike still out, you need to go put it away. Remember, it's going to get, and you get the warnings again, someone could steal it, it's going to get rusty. Okay? If they're characterized by obedience or there's something new, that may be all that needs to be there. It's simply a verbal rebuke. You're disobeying. And hopefully, they will be like the first part of Proverbs 10:17 and not the end of it. The first part is, he is on the path of life who heeds instruction. That's a good place to be, right? You don't want to be on the other part. He who ignores reproof goes astray, because it's going to get worse. Because if the rebuke is not heeded, the additional warning is ignored, then the negative consequences needed to escalate upward to some kind of related punishment, a related consequence. Or if the child was already characterized by disobedience, then you simply go to that level right away. No additional warning. We'll go back to the case of the bicycle. They left it out. I told you, I warned you, here was going to be the consequence, you lose the privilege of using your bicycle. You can't have it for whatever you've set. Now, how long they lose the privilege is going to be dependent on the child. What is they're characterized by? Is this something ongoing? Is this something that's brand new? All these factors, are they repentant? Are they not repentant? All those factors come into the actual at the time. But there's got to be a problem, a consequence of the problem there. You lose something. This is a consequence. Or it could be it got rusty, you now come out and see it's rusty and say, you know what, before you use this bike again, you got to clean it up. Get all the rust off it. That's a related natural consequence, right? Now, hopefully, they will learn from this point. Proverbs 13:1 has a great beginning. A wise son accepts his father's discipline. Yes, Dad, you're right. I'll learn my lesson. I get it back when? 3 days? Okay. They wait anxiously 3 days, and they're careful with it. And hopefully they learn that. And not the end of Proverbs 13:1, which is, a scoffer does not listen to rebuke, because it's going to get worse. Now, understand as well that when it comes to consequences of disobedience, you've got to make some sort of logical connection between the punishment and what the problem was. It makes sense to lose the use of property that's not being treated properly, right? You're not treating the bike right, you lose the privilege of using it for a while. The same thing is true in isolating your children from other children because they're being rude and mean. You can't be nice, then you lose the privilege of being with them. Go to your room or wherever you send them. Go sit in the chair. It can be for a little bit, it could be for a longer time. They're related, right? It makes sense that a child is grounded because they have squandered all their time in playing with their friends and didn't do their homework. And their grades drop. So you say, you know what, for the next month, your grades are going to improve. You're going to be sitting in your chair because you're not being wise with your time, right? That makes sense. There's a connection. But you have to be careful because some people end up making these consequences have nothing to do with what was wrong. We had one person one time was grounding their children from all church activities. Well, what was that about? Couldn't figure it out. Do you ground people from church activities because they stole the cookies and lied about it? There's no connection. So you got to think through those things. There's got to be a connection to consequences to why there is a problem. The loss of a privilege must be related to the offense for it to be effective. Now, there are also natural consequences to foolishness. The toy got broken, it got stolen, they got a skinned knee, they hurt their friend and lost a friend. And when that happens, these natural consequences, generally, there's no other consequence needs to be brought about. There's nothing, no other punishment. That's enough. Simply make sure they understand the correlation of their foolishness and the consequence. But what do you do if there is defiance, or if there's not either a natural or related consequence that really be brought to bear? Well, then you have to include artificial consequences. That will include physical chastening. And that depends on the age of the child and their overall behavior. Now, the idea of physical chastisement, spanking, it's viewed as a great evil within this society. Psychologists, sociologists, they rail against it. But on what basis? Think about it. What is the basis for their arguments? Because this is new. It doesn't exist throughout human history, and it certainly doesn't exist around the world. It's something new. What's the basis? The basis is their own worldview, even when it's contrary to fact. There is no foundation for it. I've seen reports where don't chastise your child, it'll make them violent. Guess who are the most violent kids at schools? The ones without parents who will spank them. Proverbs makes the case for physical chastisement in no uncertain terms. First, chastisement is not an option of last resort. Remember reading Bill Cosby's book on fatherhood, and that's where he put it. It finally got so bad, even he chastised his son and got his attention. But it's not a last resort option. It's a very important tool in training the heart of the child. Proverbs 22:15 tells us, foolishness is bound up in the heart of the child. The rod of discipline will remove it far from him. Okay, that's Proverbs 22:15. Proverbs 29:15 says, the rod and reproof give, guess what? Wisdom. But a child who gets his own way brings shame to his mother. But we don't seem to have much shame out of there. I've seen in the marketplace a lot of mothers that should be extremely ashamed. But they don't seem to affect them anymore. It's not a tool of last resort. It's a very important tool to train the heart of your child to wisdom. Second, physical pain is part of the chastening. But that pain is very temporary, and it is necessary to prevent something that will be permanent. Proverbs 23:13 and 14 says this, do not hold back discipline from the child. Although you strike him from the rod, he will not die. You shall strike him with the rod and rescue his soul from Sheol, death. Continued disobedience, defiance, does put the child on the path to death. Proverbs 20:20 says, he who curses his father or his mother, his lamp will go out in times of darkness. God's judgment starts playing in. God's chastening. Proverbs 30:17, this is a scary verse, the eye that mocks a father and scorns a mother, the ravens of the valley will pick it out and the young eagles will eat it. Now that's fairly graphic and I'm probably a little on the gross side. The guys like it, the girls don't. But it's meant to be graphic to push the point. Do you love your kids enough to correct them? Do you desire their death? The physical pain of chastening is brief. Yeah, some kids can really carry on for quite a while, but even that's brief. Death is permanent. Third, such chastening is an act of love. What is cruel is to fail to adequately discipline your children. Proverbs 13:24 says, he who withholds his rod hates his son. He who loves him disciplines him diligently. I put that on the sign some years ago, and I had the office still here, and I had people who would stop in to tell me how bad that sign was. How dare you put something like that in? I didn't have enough room to put it. It was from Proverbs. And I asked them, do you read your Bible? Yes, I read my Bible. Do you read Proverbs? And then I just go to the Proverbs. And they're like. And then they want to argue with me about the scriptures. Say, well, obviously you don't believe what God says, so I have nothing to say for you. There's nothing else I can do for you. But understand, it's still true. Frankly, what I find cruel are modern parenting practices. It's not cruel or hateful to spank a child properly. It is cruel and hateful to withhold it. To correct a child by isolation and other consequences that are unrelated to the problem, that's cruel. Because they're sitting there and have no idea what in the world is other than mom, dad's mad at me for something, and I'm not sure really what it is because this doesn't make sense. I find it is cruel to end up being yelling and screaming and threatening. I find it as cruel the psychological manipulations that a lot of these parenting magazines advocate now. I find it cruel that you have your children bargain for your affection, or you're withholding it from them as part of the manipulation. I find it cruel that you put them on drugs because you can't control them. And yes, there are some things that are out there and medication can help. That's not where the vast majority of the parenting is. They're on the drugs because the parents can't handle it. And the schools tell them to put on the drugs because the school can't handle it. What happened to basic discipline? I find it cruel, in fact, these would be the worst ones, indifference, or letting the child get his own way because of where it will lead them in life. That's cruel. Spanking your child, physical chastisement, it's brief. It's over, it's done with, they've learned the lesson, you go on. Now understand that I said proper physical discipline. There's cultural discipline and there is a proper biblical way. First of all, never discipline your children, especially physical chastening, in your anger. Why? James 1:19 says the anger of man does not achieve the righteousness of God, and your goal is righteousness. Calm down, make sure of your reason for the chastening, and then go do it properly. And yes, you can use that for your advantage, because if you're really angry, you put your children in a room and say, I will be back. You know your children are thinking about it. All right? But you go get calm first. Then come back. Be angry and do not sin. Don't let them get to you. The discipline needs to be related to and appropriate to the offense. And that means you've got to consider factors such as the child's age, their general behavior, the frequency of the offense, and the particular circumstances. For example, young children tend to commit a lot of hand offenses. They're always grabbing something. And you'd say, no. Well, it's appropriate. Slap their hand. That's it. That's all that's often needed. A high sting, whack, and it's like, okay, I'm not touching that then. Okay, it reinforces the lesson. Do not touch. Now, if they're not responding to that and they keep going, you may have to increase the pain level. So you slap them on the thigh. Or you may have to increase to get an implement and whack them on the buttock. Okay, why use an implement? I had an argument with a lady from CPS one time. She never did take me up on my offer. I said, I'll come down and train your whole crew here in biblical chastisement because I think it's wrong for parents to claim, Bible tells me to do this, and they're wailing on their kids. It's wrong. And then she said, well, maybe you can use a wooden spoon. No, I said, you can't see me, but I have a fairly good-sized hand. If I whack my children with my hand, they're sailing across the room. And you say a hand's okay? Or a wooden spoon bruises. Use an implement that is firm yet flexible so it causes a high sting but doesn't damage the child. In fact, one of the things that you can tell that you've gone too far is when you're leaving bruising. If that's going on, you're using either too much force or you're using the wrong instrument. You need to change what you're doing. A piece of leather, 1.5, 2 inches wide, maybe that long, is very appropriate. We called ours a whacker. The kids got good at hiding them. But they worked. Now, why do this? Again, it is simply the goal is to bring about enough pain, a high sting, that deters the behavior without physically damaging your child. That's your goal. That's it. You're trying to deter the behavior. If the behavior is not being deterrent, you need to go back and look at what you're doing in your discipline. Something's still wrong. Now, gaining control of the behavior of your young children, frankly, is the easy part. The harder part is training their heart, but that is your goal. And that is why discipline, again, begins with teaching and training about God and His commands and includes the reproofs that give the moral reasons for the corrections and the chastening. They have to understand what God is saying about this. That is training their heart. And as the child does get older, the outward behavior, the defiance, becomes less frequent, and other types of correction then, which I've already mentioned, become more dominant. Related consequences, natural consequences. But young children, it's going to be a lot of physical chastening. In fact, in general terms, if you are training your children properly, by the time they're, say, 5 or 6 years old, Most of their behavior is going to be under control. I mean, this will have episodes, but most of it, generally, they're going to be under control by 5 or 6 years old. Most of their chastising is done, and they don't even remember it much. Now, there are exceptions, but these are in general terms. By the time a child is 12 or 13, they should be able to be controlled internally by their own love for God and a desire to do right. That's why 12 or 13 is a bar mitzvah or a bat mitzvah in the Jewish faith. That is the son of the law. By here, you should know it enough to go do it yourself. And such children, by the time they're in their late teens, early 20s, you know what? They're friends and peers. And they're a real joy to have around. Proverbs 23:24 talks about that kind of joy of the parents. Now, those are worthy goals, but there's something more important in your motivation than training your children than for you to enjoy them. And that is that their lives reflect godliness so that they will glorify God, period. That's why there should be joy. And if they're doing that, you will have joy. But that has to be the real motivation. And if it takes longer with your children than these general things, okay, it takes longer. That's all. There's a lot of reasons it may take longer. You may have a more stubborn child. You may not have learned any of these things until your children were older. But don't fret. And do not become weary in well-doing. Resolve to continue to properly discipline your children, the positive as well as the negative side, so that they will become a blessing to you, to themselves, to others, and to God.